You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Most Americans probably learned what they know about professional bike racing by reading in the press about Lance Armstrong's record-breaking 7 consecutive Tour de France victories, and later that he'd been stripped of those medals because he'd used performance-enhancing substances. But I'd guess only a few Americans understand how a professional bike racing team is organized and how essential the skill and endurance of a bike team supporting riders, its domestiques, is to the team leader's success. For 20 years, George Hincapie was among the sport's top domestiques, helping Lance Armstrong and later Mark Cavendish and Cadel Evans win the sport's most difficult races. He discusses his career and his own use of banned substances in The Loyal Lieutenant, a memoir he wrote with Craig Hummer. It's published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Perhaps it should have come as no surprise that when I looked up domestique in Wikipedia, the first thing I saw was a photo of you on a bike. Should I assume that when you first started racing, you dreamt about being the star of a professional bike racing team?
Absolutely. I started racing right down the street in Queens, Richmond Hill, Queens, and I did most of my early races in Central Park and in Prospect Park. And that's where I learned how to race a bike. And, of course, at an early age, I won pretty much everything I entered and dreamed of being one of the top guys winning the Tour de France later on in my career.
So at what point did you decide that you were happy playing a supporting role in helping another rider finish first?
Well, pretty early on in my career, I realized that I was probably one of the best in the world at helping others get the wins, whether that shepherded them in the peloton with positioning or keeping them out of trouble or really being able to make the calls. A lot of people don't understand all that goes into being a top domestique, but that's a lot of pressure that comes with that. You're relied on day to day to make decisions that the coach can't see at that instant. And I found out early on that I was good at that, and I chose to focus on something that I was really good at.
The peloton is the group of riders that are all bunched together.
Correct.
And it can be rather dangerous. And so part of your job was to find ways to get through and to help Lance or whoever else you were being a domestique for to get through without getting into trouble.
Absolutely.
It's like a quarterback.
Yeah, for sure. It's you go through many different road surfaces. You go through roads that are sizes of highways onto roads that are size of a bike path with 200 riders fighting for position. So a lot of people just know what happens at the last mile of a race, but there's so much that goes into to it before that.
So is it nerve-wracking to ride in a large pack like that?
Well, I was a professional for 19 years and raced my bike for 30 years. So after a while, it was not as nerve-wracking. And there was always risk involved and the fear of crashing, but the nerves faded away after a while.
Well, if somebody in front of you falls,
yeah, of course,
you're almost guaranteed to fall.
You're guaranteed to fall. And a lot of these races, the Tour de France or the big World Cup races, there's a high risk of crashing in any of those races.
Lance Armstrong is riding alongside you in that Wikipedia photo that I mentioned. Is it difficult to be so closely associated in the public eye, at least with someone who has had such a dramatic fall from grace?
I know Lance personally quite well. I've known him since he was a kid. We grew up racing bikes together. We never expected being thrown into that world. It's not like we decided together that we were going to dope. It's like we were thrown into a world that we felt like at the time we didn't have a choice. And now looking back, I know those were wrong choices. I know that Lance personally hurt a lot of people, and I think he is truly sorry for that, and I hope that he can move on and pass that.
Well, you've had an on-again, off-again friendship, but he provided a very warm introduction to this book, and he also, you have some of his thoughts and other people's thoughts interspersed throughout the book. So I guess everybody, at least some people, have made up.
Yeah, definitely we've been through a lot together. Love him or hate him, he knows a lot about the sport of cycling. He knows a lot about myself as a teammate and myself as a person.
Your colleagues turned against you after it was leaked to the press that you and several other riders had testified before the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, and you say the press camped out on your back lawn, on your front lawn, I guess. Your phone rang off the hook, but Lance continued to support you. So I guess that was important at the time.
Yeah, I mean, he's done some good things for people. He's obviously was very passionate about his cancer foundation, and he still continues to be passionate about that, and he was supportive of actually after all the recent decision stuff came about as well.
Your book is about a lot more than drug use and blood doping, but it's something you do address in it. So let's get it out of the way, okay? Wasn't there a time early in your racing career that you noticed a real shift from one season to the next and the ability of the riders around you?
Absolutely. I mean, the sport has been dealing with that problem for long before my era. My era just happened to be one where it got a bit more sophisticated, and there was a time in 95, 96 where the speeds got incredibly faster, and all of a sudden you go from being one of the best guys in the world to barely being able to hold on to the guy who's the most out of shape in the peloton. And the peloton's a small world. People talk about what's going on, and for a while there was a time where you don't even feel like you're doing wrong, because you feel like, well, you just don't want to get behind the ball. You know that what people are doing, and looking back, I know that that's not a valid argument. It's still wrong, but that's what my mindset was at the time.
Well, everybody's doing it. I got to do this to keep up. And the drug was EPO or erythropoietin?
Yes.
Riders also engage in blood doping. Can you explain how that works?
It was just also another unfortunate part about the sport that basically you pull out your own blood and put it back in a few weeks later. It's something that I never have to face again. And
why is that illegal? It's your blood. You haven't done anything to it.
It's a performance enhancer. That's why it's illegal.
You've written that you purchased your first EPO in a Swiss drugstore over the counter.
Yep.
And you began using it sporadically starting in 1996. Did you notice an immediate improvement in your performance?
Well, not really. I mean, at the time, I said it was pretty, like I said, it was pretty widespread. So I went from being able to barely survive in the peloton to all of a sudden surviving. So there wasn't a huge performance or success immediately. By far, not at all.
But it was allowing you to keep up. But were you driving? So you weren't driving fast. You were driving the same as everybody else.
Correct.
Your body recovered a little quicker, perhaps?
Yes, yeah.
I assume that you understood that using EPO was against the rules. Did you feel guilty or embarrassed about that?
Like I said earlier, my value systems then in my 20s and early 30s were different than they are now. And now I'm wiser and older, and I know that that was wrong. But at the time, I truly felt like I wasn't doing wrong. And it's good that now I'm able to talk about it and mentor younger riders not to make those decisions. And I know the sport's in a lot better place now, and I don't envision that ever happening again in our sport.
Early on in the tour, weren't riders taking ether and drinking alcohol to cope with the pain?
In the early years?
Is that legal?
Before
they started using EPO.
Yeah, there was all kinds of stuff going on for a long time in the history of the sport, and it's a completely different sport now. Riders are winning races clean, and I've witnessed that firsthand.
And you say that you stopped using banned substances, began riding clean in 2006. So the culture had already started to change, and you felt comfortable doing that?
Yeah, I felt like I got to a point in my career where I was in an influential position. I was sick of the doping. I wanted to be part of the change. So I made it my sort of mission to be an advocate of clean racing.
But you've also contended that the enforcement authorities made a mistake when they went after individual bike racers for their use of drugs rather than trying to clean up the sport as a whole.
Well, I think more of what I was saying was I think the emphasis was put on one team and a few riders as opposed to a whole generation. As you saw, after the recent decision came out, one rider per week was coming out from different teams saying, I did the same thing. And then you were able to see, you know, how widespread it really was.
And a lot of people who denied for years and years wound up then finally going public about what they'd done, like Floyd Landis.
Yes.
My guest is George Hincapie, who, with the help of Craig Hummer, has written a memoir called The Loyal Lieutenant, My Story. You've interspersed, as I said earlier, interspersed comments made by teammates, family members, riders you race against throughout the book. And one of them, Jonathan Vauders, suggested that both you and Lance Armstrong would have been much better off if drugs hadn't been a part of cycling when you raced, because you're both such strong athletes.
Well, for me, that was obvious in my latter part of my career. I was still able to ride amongst the best, help the best riders in the world win the biggest races in the world. And I'd been around for a long time. I never saw any indication of doping on the teams that I was on, you know, from 2007 on. And I know that I was a witness of riders winning races clean. And because of my levels, I was able to do this similar performances that I had always done.
You're listed on your website as being 6'3" and weighing 163 pounds. Isn't that fairly large for a bike racer?
It's above average, definitely above average, but I would get really lean for the Tour de France.
Lean also means you have less energy, doesn't it?
There's a fine line. It's all about power-to-weight ratio. If you're going over these 20-mile climbs that are, you know, it's hot, the climbs are really steep, you want to be as lean as possible.
Did your size, especially your long legs, give you an advantage?
I think so. I had more of an advantage of being able to see a lot better in the peloton. When you're in the middle of a 200-rider peloton, it's very important to know what's coming. So that helped a lot. Also, I was able to maneuver my way around the peloton a bit easier than the smaller riders.
Was it a disadvantage when you needed to ride uphill for long periods of time?
It really depends. You can train your body to do anything. I moved to South Carolina to be closer to the mountains and made sure I would ride mountains every day. Obviously, growing up in Richmond Hill, Queens, there was no mountains. So I had that disadvantage early on in my career, but later on I made cycling my life, and I did everything I could to become a better climber.
Your parents were from Colombia. Is bike racing popular in Colombia?
Very popular. It's second to soccer.
So how old were you when you began racing as an amateur?
8 years old.
Were there races in New York City that you could participate in, or did have to go elsewhere?
Every weekend, Central Park, starting in the spring, Central Park, all of March, and then April in Prospect Park.
And then when you were just 20 years old, you were invited to join the Motorola team for the 1994 season. Is that a typical age for a bike racer to turn professional?
It's fairly young. I did 1 year as an amateur, and then I turned professional. It was definitely on the younger side for people to turn pro, and I race a lot longer than most people race.
And you remember being thrilled to receive your team kit. What's a team kit?
Yeah. Well, basically, you get a suitcase full of brand-new clothing. You know, as a 19-year-old kid, you had never really gotten that much cycling gear in your whole life, and all of a sudden you get a full suitcase of, you know, 20 jerseys and 30 pairs of shorts and jackets and all kinds of stuff that that's where you realize you made the big time.
And you were racing mostly in Europe, weren't you?
Yes.
So you were traveling a lot, but you also perhaps got a little homesick.
Absolutely. I moved to Italy when I was 20 years old, a culture that at the time I didn't understand, I didn't appreciate, and I was homesick all the time. Now, of course, that's changed. I love Europe, and I love all the different cultures and appreciate all the different differences there.
A listener has called in wondering whether blood doping is dangerous. Do you run the risk of embolism?
I'm not a doctor. That I don't know. I'm not an expert.
And nobody said to you, this is dangerous. They just simply said, this might help.
Yes.
My guest is George Hincapie. His memoir, The Loyal Lieutenant, My Story, Leading Out Lance and Pushing Through the Pain on the Rocky Road to Paris. It is published by William Morrow, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with George Hincapie, who, with the help of Craig Hummer, has written The Loyal Lieutenant, My Story, Leading Out Lance and Pushing Through the Pain on the Rocky Road to Paris. It's published by William Morrow. Was Lance Armstrong already riding for the team when you joined it?
When I joined Motorola,
yeah.
He was, yes.
Was he the team's acknowledged leader when you signed on? Were you brought in specifically to support him?
No, he was only, when I signed, I was 20 years old. He was probably 22 or 23, so he was still considered a young rider on the team, although he won the world championships at a very young age.
Does the pay vary depending on whether you are going to be the team leader, or are you going to be a domestic?
Absolutely, yes.
So what were you signed as?
As a helper, a young, unexperienced rider.
How many riders does a professional bike racing team usually have?
Anywhere from 15 to 25.
And they generally have one person who is designated the leader or the star, or does that change over the course of a season or even over the course of a race?
Absolutely. It changes over the course of a race. Typically, there'll be one leader for the Tour de France, but we would do 60 to 100 races a year, and you can have anywhere from 4 to 5 to 7 different leaders for all of those races.
But do you know at the start of a race who the leader is going to be?
Yes, typically yes. But that can change during the race as well. The leader can realize he's having a bad day, and one of the helpers can say, hey, I'm on a great day. And, that's what makes a team successful, is being able to make those decisions on the road and being able to realize when you're not having a great day and you're able to help another rider who is having a great day.
And you're saying helper rather than domestique. Domestique, yeah. Means servant. Maybe that's domestique. Slightly insulting.
I'm trying to keep it simple, but it's in Europe, they're called domestiques. Absolutely.
Will you give us a quick description of how a helper, a domestique, will actually help the team leader?
Sure. Well, he's many times relied on to make a lot of tactical decisions in the race, where we'll have coaches behind us in the cars, but they're not able to see exactly what's going on at any given moment. But there's many times where you're going down a road that's a big size road, and you have a right-hander coming up in a mile that becomes a bike path with a bunch of cobblestones on it. And if you're not in the front or the first 10 guys, you may never see the front again. So a domestique will take their leader on their wheel and shepherd them through the peloton while the whole time he's conserving energy. So he's able to get to those sections in the front, have the energy conserved because he didn't go into the wind to get to the front of that section, and be able to use it for later on in the race.
So you're the one who is using up all the energy because
yes.
We've seen bike races draft each other in a long line. How much energy does it save to be behind somebody else?
Roughly 20%.
That much?
Yes, it's a big deal.
So even if you're doing great, somewhere along the line you're going to flag because you've just been expending 20% more energy.
Absolutely.
Than the
yes.
person you're leading.
Yes.
The Tour de France, which gets so much publicity, is just one of three so-called Grand Tour bike races that are held each year. What countries are the other two held in?
In Italy and Spain.
And how many days do these Grand Tour races last?
21 days.
Do they all pretty much cover the same amount of miles?
Pretty much. Anywhere from 2,000 miles to 2,800 miles in 3 weeks.
So do teams usually ride in all three Grand Tours every year?
Yes, the teams are made up of roughly 25 riders, and not typically does it's very rare that one rider will do all three, but several riders will do all two.
The team leader won't be in all three?
Usually not.
The team leader is the one who wears a yellow jersey, so everybody knows who you're protecting.
Yes. Well, I mean, there could be a team leader that is also not at the front of the race, but he has a chance to become a leader later on in the race.
So then they switch shirts?
Well, yeah, the jersey will be given to another rider, but the lead can change daily in a Grand Tour.
Your first Grand Tour was the Tour of Spain in 1995. Was it anything like you'd expected?
It was a lot harder than I ever imagined. I remember that was probably some of the most I've ever suffered on the bike in my life. I also had a very bad crash, but it made me wanting more, and maybe he wanted to come back and do another one.
When you have a crash, that means you're pretty much out of the race because it's pretty
hard
to catch.
I actually finished that one. I crashed 2 days before the end, coming into a sprint downhill, going 40 miles an hour, and cracked my helmet into pieces and strained my neck, and did the next two stages with a neck brace. But I was determined to get to the finish of that race.
So it's just finishing was enough of an accomplishment.
At that point, as a 21-year-old kid, finishing was a big accomplishment.
Why is the Tour de France so much better known than the other Grand Tours? Is it more difficult?
All three Grand Tours are probably just as difficult. The Tour de France just for some reason gets a lot more media attention, and it is the biggest. One of the biggest sporting events in the world.
Now, in a later tour, you also broke a collarbone.
Yes.
And yet you hold a record for riding in more tours, 17, and finishing more tours, 16, than anyone in history.
Yes.
Do other people tend to also break bones?
Oh, yeah. I've personally left a lot of skin on the road in France. But riders, there was a rider who's one of America's greatest talents on Monday. Taylor Finney crashed into a guardrail at 40 miles an hour and broke his lower leg in two places. So it could happen at any moment. It's a very dangerous sport. My prayers go out to him. I hope he recovers quickly.
Because you usually played a supporting role in the tour, you only got the chance to stand on the leaders' podium a few times. And one of them was in 2003 when you were one of the three top finishers in a team time trial. You've said that changed your life. What happened?
Well, I met my wife on the podium.
You flirted with her?
I flirted with her.
You got her fired?
I got her fired. It was actually the first stage of the tour. I spent the rest of the tour trying to get her phone number. I finally got it, not from her, from somebody else. And I was very determined to get her number. And finally, I would say my charm got her talking to me, but I don't think I have much charm. But here we are 10 years later, and we just had our third child. And I'm very fortunate to have her in my life.
Well, she didn't speak English.
She spoke a little English and Spanish, and I speak Spanish fluently. So between the little English and the little French that I spoke and the little Spanish she spoke, we communicated as best as we could.
In addition to the tours we've discussed, you raced in a great number of races that are called classics. What are classics?
Classics are the sort of the one-day monumental, most historical races on the calendar. There's 12 of them. They're usually over 150 miles long. They usually have either an iconic climb or a cobblestone sort of rock road, like Paris-Roubaix and Tour of Flanders. And these are by far the hardest one-day races in the world.
Do you prepare differently for the shorter races than the longer ones?
Yeah, definitely. There's different training. There's different... there's a lot different tactics involved, and everything has changed for the one-day races as opposed to the stage races.
My guest is George Hincapie. His memoir, The Loyal Lieutenant, My Story, Leading Out Lance and Pushing Through the Pain on the Rocky Road to Paris, is published by William Morrow. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. He also competed in the Olympics five times?
Yes.
With that... over how many years?
20 years.
So, and you were, how old were you when you were on the first Olympic
18.
Team? 18. Do you think that part of your success came from, well, how well did you do in the Olympics?
I never did that well. I think my best place was probably 7th or 8th in Sydney.
And how does it compare with the other kinds of races?
The Olympics... obviously is the pinnacle of the sport and many amateur sports. It's a very big deal in cycling as well because you get to represent your country. But lots of times the Olympics falls in not a great ideal place on the calendar for cycling. It's usually right after the Tour de France. So it really
so
just
you're tired.
You're tired. It really just depends on how you recover from the Tour de France and how you're feeling for that one-day race.
Well, do you think that your success came from you being able to withstand more physical punishment and suffering than some of the people you were competing against?
Well, certainly that was attributed to my success and just my desire and my will. I never took my position for granted, and I always worked hard, and I considered myself lucky to be a professional cyclist, something that I dreamed of doing my whole life.
Well, how much of it is physical and how much of it is mental?
It's all about equal. There's a lot of hard work and a lot of determination and desire.
Well, I ask because wasn't your favorite race each year the Paris-Roubaix?
Yes.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
It involves riding a grueling 150 miles over cobblestones?
Yes.
It's bad enough to ride over cobblestones in Brooklyn streets.
Yeah, that's definitely by far the toughest one-day race in the world.
And then you've written that you were happy when the weather turned nasty during that race, rain and snow flurries.
Well, I knew that if when I woke up in the morning, I wasn't exactly ecstatic that it was raining and snowing, but I knew that half the competition that was waking up at the same time as me would look out the window, and they had already given up in their mind. So you're basically racing against half the peloton in those circumstances.
Were you ever able to win that race?
I got second once.
You did win a number of races. You were the U.S. National Road Race Champion in 1998, 2006, 2009.
Yes.
Now, 2009, you were already getting on in years.
Yes.
did you feel the difference, or were you you feel just as strong as you did when you were younger?
Actually, the older I got, the more I knew my body. So when you're young, I feel like you're in a constant state of overtraining. When you're older, you really know how important, you get to realize how important rest is. So you know, even though you might get tired quicker or you might not recover as fast, you know that, hey, if I need 2 days off, it's actually probably a lot better than taking 1 day off and trying to push through it. So I got a lot wiser in my training, and I knew my body a lot more when I was older.
What kind of diet did you rely on?
Very strict diet.
A lot of pasta?
During the races, yes, but a lot of times you're trying to watch your intake of calories because, like I said earlier, it's all about power to weight. So I'm happy that I'm retired now and not have to worry about that.
And you retired just a couple of years ago, 2012.
Yes.
You made that announcement before your final Tour de France. You said that part of the reason was that you knew that you were facing suspension from the sport because of your own doping, but you had already quit.
Well, I had been trying to retire for a few years before that, just because I'd been racing my bike at that point for 19 years as a professional, and I just happened to be getting on great teams each year and every year. So it was difficult for me to leave the sport, but emotionally, the reason decision time was a very difficult period in my life, and I just felt like not only because of that happening, but I thought that was probably just enough for me. I couldn't handle it emotionally anymore.
So what do you do when you retire from professional racing?
Well, I'm a dad. I get to spend a lot more time with my kids. And we have a family business that I work with as well.
You manufacture bike clothing?
Yes, we manufacture bike clothing. And just being able to spend more time at home. I've been on racing my bike for 30 years. My life was consumed by cycling for 30 years, and it's nice to be able to focus on other things now.
But you also recently opened a hotel that caters to bicyclists.
Yes, as well, yes.
And you didn't call it the Hotel Helper. You called it the Hotel Domestique.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a term that can be used for the hotel industry as well, and we just thought it was a good fit.
And so do a lot of bike riders, I guess you don't call them bikers,
bicyclists. I actually call them bikers, and people make fun of me.
Well, bikers are my people on motorcycles.
I know. I call them bikers as well. Yeah, we do have a lot of cyclists, bikers there as well. But it's a great food and wine destination also. We have a great chef. And we have a wonderful menu as well.
And this is in
South Carolina.
South Carolina. I'm assuming you're still there because you like the terrain.
Well, I moved there initially because of the terrain. I thought the riding is probably some of the best on the East Coast by far. But now I live there because it is a great place to raise a family. And my wife, who's French, she also loves it there. So we don't really see any reason to leave.
Well, you just became a father for the third time?
Yes, 10 days ago.
But are the other kids already riding bicycles?
We ride for fun. My kids, they like to ride, but by no means am I pushing them into cycling.
Has there been much reaction to your book? Did you give away any secrets that people had hoped would remain buried?
I was quite candid in the book and transparent. I'll leave it to the readers to decide. I don't think I gave away any secrets. The book is not about doping. The book is not about calling out people that haven't been called out. For me, the biggest point of the book is how much the sport has actually changed, which I think has not been talked about much recently.
Well, there are people who say that that any AIDS might be understandable because this is really just such a grueling physical experience. It's almost impossible to demand this sort of thing from people on a regular basis.
Well, early on it was impossible, almost impossible to race without it. But now, as you'll see in the book, the sport has changed dramatically. And
well, it just means that the times are slower?
Well, the times are even in some respects getting faster, but nutrition has evolved tremendously. Training has evolved. Equipment has evolved. The fabric to the bikes, everything is, the technology is incredible in cycling now. So that helps a lot with the times. And like I said, really now there aren't any shortcuts. It's all about the sport being life consuming. You race, you train, you sleep and eat cycling. That's the only way to make it to the top.
So the bikes are better than they used to be.
Absolutely.
That's like making golf clubs that will hit the ball further.
Yes.
How is that all that different from doping?
Well, that may be another discussion. I don't really touch upon that in the book, but the bikes, the wheels are lighter, they're faster, they're more aerodynamic. So it's you cannot compare today's bike to a bike from 20 years ago.
Your co-author here is Craig Hummer, who's an Emmy-nominated sports broadcaster. Is this an as-told-to book, or did you actually write it out longhand?
As told to. We spoke every night for a year on Skype. We visited each other throughout the course of the year as well.
George Hincapie's book, with the help of Craig Hummer, is called The Loyal Lieutenant, My Story, Leading Out Lance and Pushing Through the Pain on the Rocky Road to Paris. And it must have been exciting when you finally reached Paris after having gone through some pretty rough terrain.
Yes.
Is riding through Paris the really easy part? There are cobblestones there?
It's actually still quite a tough stage.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.